Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Well, we know Alan Gergen is a great storyteller, and you know, also the respected author across the country, across the world, including just recently some fantastic short stories. A great one in The New Yorker about the reptile farm in Florida, and can't talk about all of them. The one, Alan, that you read on NPR at Christmas time a year and a half ago, recently in Harper's, that took us back to the flood. So we don't need to prove that you're a great writer, do we? But something that we have not tested you on before is your editing skills, your choosing skills. And you wrote recently in the Oxford American, in preparation, sort of describing the process that you went through as this year's editor of the upcoming New Stories from the South series, the best of 2006. So I persuaded you to come in and talk about some of the things that you shared in that essay, and some of, including those which you learned for the first time or were reinforced in connection with this project for New Stories. So that's by way of background. Now you talk.
All right, great. Well, thank you. It's always good to talk to you, DG. Algonquin has for 20 years published New Stories from the South, a prize collection. Shannon Ravenel was the editor of Best American Stories for years before she co-founded Algonquin Books. So it seemed a natural thing to take advantage of the Southern plethora of depth of talent. And she's done it for two solid decades. My respect for her has more than quadrupled because this essentially arrived as an invitation saying, would you be the first writer to choose from the entire year of short stories from the South? And my impulse, I've become increasingly impulsive. I just had my 59th birthday. I better get impulsive now or it's never going to happen. Was just to say, oh, yeah, this is going to be fun. I'm going to make this fun. I knew that it would be sort of like taking the SAT. It's at a certain point that it would go on, the math section would go on a little too long. But and there are 12 months in the year, and there are these things called monthlies, meaning magazines. But after reading, I guess, hundreds and hundreds of stories, I was allowed to choose 20. Usually there's been about 14 in the collection, but I had so many winners that I had to force them in. And I learned a lot. About being an editor, which is not as easy as it looks. You've got to love what you work with. You know, I didn't want any story in this grouping that hadn't really rung all my gongs and sung the song many times over. And of course, what I discovered very quickly was that the Southern short story is alive and very, very well. Now, some people say that the short story is an American invention. People say that it's lay it to Edgar Allan Poe, who was lived in Richmond and died in Baltimore, so he was a Southerner. I wrote this essay for the Oxford American, and I've since gotten a letter from somebody saying, well, actually, Washington Irving invented the short story, but his folks were from Texas, so he counts. So I'm claiming him as a Southerner, too.
It's so funny that you did this. I've written a column alluding to the Rip Van Winkle story and the Rip Van Winkle state, which North Carolina was, and so I had to go back and read Rip Van Winkle short story. I said, oh, wait a minute. Well, I've got to ask Alan about this.
Well, he's great. I mean, Washington Irving is somebody you can really read, and he's generally known as the first professional writer that this country ever produced.
South, so we can.
That's right. They've got Texas claims. But you know, you suddenly get the stack of 3 inches of short stories and you read those and you think, well, that does it. And then suddenly there's another stack and another stack. I started traveling with 3 big quilted envelopes. One said yes, one said maybe, one said no. And originally there was a whole bunch in the maybe group and a lot in the yes.
You mentioned this is the maybe stack. Those of us who have written essays, mainly school, we wonder how those of our teachers would sort them out. And you did it with these 3 envelopes. So I'm curious, all of these stories, the hundreds of them, maybe up to 800 stories that you had to look at, were published by somebody or selected by somebody. And you talk to our friends who are writing stories now. It's not like automatic that somebody's going to publish them. So all of these were selected competitively. So these maybes must have been pretty good.
They're fine. I mean, maybe means maybe. But the fact is that if you are asked to choose the very, very best, I mean, let's be sexist and make it a beauty contest of the most beautiful girls from the age of 15 to 20. Let's just go ahead and be a pig. And imagine that they're all lovely. I mean, from my age, everybody that age looks gorgeous. You know, they're beautiful. Every shopping mall has a Greta Garbo and a John Wayne. But some are more beautiful than others. And if you're really having to choose and you're really asked to be the juror, then you have to say, you know what? I have lost interest on the bottom of page 1. The title interested me, but until page 4, nothing really happens. Or occasionally I would find essentially a novella that was extremely good for its first third. And I began to think, well, maybe I should include just the first third of this. Then suddenly there was another 100 stories. So if you only have 20 slots, 15 or 20 slots, then you really have to say, what are my biases? And my biases are, I am looking for a story that will buttonhole me and say, you must hear me out. I have a piece of information. I have a serious, hilarious experience that you have to hear about.
It's not a brush by, this is a grab.
This is a grab. And it's what the journalism schools teach us, you know, what is your hook? I mean, it's a hideous phrase if you're a fish, but it's what we're all looking for as readers is an offer you can't refuse. And so these 20 out of the hundreds that I read are the ones that kept moving from maybe to yes.
Let me interrupt you real quickly because I'm interested in this procedure. I want to be sure I've got it right. You've got 3 envelopes. The no's, going to the no pile, they're never coming back. Going to the maybe pile, that's kind of like purgatory, I guess. If you go into the yes pile, though, that's just a yes if it fits kind of pile. Is that, or if you, how am I going to ask this question? Did the yes pile ever get to be more than 20? Did you have more than
20? There were some that were near misses. Some of them were
to 30 or 40 or 50.
No, never more than 35, I would say. But some of them were like a better story, a story that began with a crazy aunt on the roof, or I don't know, and so. Some were eliminated on account of that.
They eliminated later.
They come later. Then you have to make a shape. You see, I mean, I write books. I make books. And though I contributed the introductory essay in this collection, this is one of my babies. This is one of my books. I want the reader to be able to read story 1 through story 20 and have a sense that something is being resolved. Story 2 in this collection is an absolutely hair-raising story by a very gifted woman named Carrie Holiday, which is a based on an actual event from 1745 from what's now Tennessee, in which a black slave was burned at the stake for poisoning her master. And this happened very close to the place where Carrie Holiday lives in Tennessee. And she had the historic record. She had the court transcript. But she never really believed that this woman had done the deed. And so the story is a kind of vindication, belated vindication of this woman. Originally, I was going to make that the first story in the collection to sort of sound a theme and to try to work out a theme using other people's stories. Exactly.
Very horrible, gripping.
Exactly. I've now placed it second after a very, very funny and accomplished Tony Early story called Yard Art, which is about folk art and our fetishization of folk art as affluent Southerners. But I mean, I'm suggesting that I was making a shape in this book, and it was not just a ragtag collection.
We're talking to Alan Gervinus, and we're talking about Southern short fiction based on his experience as the editor of this year's New Stories from the South, and he and I'll be right back. Back to Who's Talking. Visiting with Alan Gervinus. Alan is from Hillsboro, a great writer, great both the novels of short fiction, and those who studied under him say also that he's a fantastic teacher of writing. But he's learned something new as he's moved on in age, and that is that this year he's the guest editor of New Stories from the South, and as a part of that, he's worked on an essay that was recently published in the Oxford American, and describing both the process of selection and what you learned, what you think is important, I guess is a better way to say it, about Southern writing and about short stories. And so I'd love for you just to kind of share as you look back those thoughts.
Yeah, well, I used to think about the short story and the Southern mode as belonging to Faulkner and Eudora Welty and Flannery O'Connor. And what's fun, DG, is seeing that energy transferred to contemporary subject matter, the same sense of humor, the same interest in place and in genealogy, the same obsession with race and history, sort of brought up to date and made manifest in contemporary Nashville and the outcroppings of the overpaid country music industry.
Is that putting that image in our mind? That is that what the South is that?
Well, that's one of the Souths. Another, I think, and one of the things that I was hoping to find, I didn't quite find it in this collection, but I hope the next editor or the next one will find it, is the story written by a young Mexican-American who has arrived, you know, by swimming the Rio Grande on her mother's back and has gone through public high school in Rocky Mount or Statesville and is now writing her vision of the North American South with all the Aztec mythology brought to bear on the big houses,
and
that's what I'm waiting for, and I'm very excited to read that because I think that's also Faulkner's South updated. But part of the joy for me of agreeing to read these hundreds of stories was finding very, very quickly with the first load that the material is still so electric and so alive, and even the stories that I couldn't include proved to me that there was something very, very exciting and operative in the form.
Can you illustrate that for us in terms of what the themes are? I mean, if you describe the Flannery O'Connor and the Faulkner themes, now they seem to be, as we retell them, not as original and gripping. They all in Hackney as we try to copy them. But there, are there new themes that are consistent with those themes that?
Well, yeah, I think they're. I mean, one of the things that we can do now that was more difficult at when they were writing is write about sexuality. I think people write about sexuality with a great deal more license. I don't think necessarily with more ease, because we're all Calvinists. God bless our repressive souls.
In writing about sexuality than we would if we were living in the Midwest or something.
Well, these long, hot summers, you know, anything can happen. Neighbors wander over. There's no telling what might go on. One of the stories that I use to end the collection is about middle-aged people who fall erotically in love and swim out to sea surrounded by dolphins. It was a very strange and beautiful finale for the collection. But one of the things that's been pleasurable in reading these hundreds of stories is to reconsider the short story form itself. And I've gotten more excited about it, I have to say, than I've been in years, and about its possibilities. You know, you think, well, I do this kind of story, or this is my vision of the story. But I found that I kept being knocked off my own pins and brought up short. I mean, one of the stories in the collection is an extended investigation of newspaper sports writing, a game that goes on and on and on, and all the cliches of sports writing, but shot through with a kind of metaphysical quality. So I found myself just bouncing around with excitement with the short story itself.
But typically we say that some of the things that distinguish us, our love of the land and attachment to it, the war that we lost, race as a thread, or threads that are woven through every aspect of Southern life. And so the question that intrigues me that you had to deal with is, are those things still important as distinguishing factors in the things that people write, Southerners write, or that people who write about the South have to take into account?
I think they're still here, and maybe I was showing my generational bias to look for certain elements, but I felt that I found them, and that there's some, I don't know, there are only three or four stories that are being told endlessly, you know, and one of the things that we have going for us as a region is that we are still a great region of talkers. And that people talked, well, first people sang, and then people talked, and then people wrote down what they'd said. And so I think as a race of talkers, black and white and brown, we have a tremendous advantage. And we have an advantage in that buttonhole quality that I was talking about earlier, where somebody says, you know, something just happened to me that you got to hear about. You can't leave. You can't leave me. Don't let me not tell you this. And that kind of urgency is particular, I think, to the short story, because it is like a conversation. It's 12 pages. It's the length of a good long talk between friends.
Yeah, I wish I could frame this, but that really speaks to me. You talk of, you're a salesman for the short story in many respects in your essay. I mean, you could pick any one of a number of paragraphs. Here's one that you said that though New York publishing houses publishing still treats the short story as a hair-lipped stepchild always tagging along behind that heiress called the novel, the story continues as our literature's truest Cinderella.
Absolutely.
Well, I'm quoting you, so.
Oh, well, that makes perfect sense. No wonder. I also think that given the way we live now, which is very, very fast with a million interruptions, that it would seem to be the golden age of the short story. I think the novella and the short story should be stacked on every bedside table, because that's how people live now. I mean, the great short story writer Peter Taylor said that a novella is a work of fiction that can be picked up after dinner and finished just at bedtime. And I think many people would resist buying a 800-page, four-tiered Victorian novel because they think, when am I ever going to finish this damn thing? Whereas a book comprised of shorter units, and especially a book like this that is made up of many voices, would seem to be the perfect sort of solution for our appetite for reading. I don't know. I think publishing has something to do with it. I think publishing is a very traditional and entrenched industry, and they see that novels sell more copies and have traditionally, and instead of overturning that and investigating how to make a shorter form sell, they stick with what's tried and tested.
Well, a couple more of your quotes, which show your bias. Like vocal music, stories consist wholly of what singers call exposed notes, meaning if you go sharp, everybody's going to hear. And then you go on, novels are more forgiving. Chapters can vary in quality. They can be assembled so the weaker unit gets popped in between its betters, which means that translating Alan Gerganus means that the short story has to be a perfect jewel, whereas a novel doesn't have to be cut perfectly at every facet.
Exactly, or it's pure protein as opposed to a sandwich, which is a carbohydrate layer beside a protein layer. And that puts the writer, as I suggest, in an odd exposed position. But if you're ready for the exposure, and if you're willing to revise and read the work aloud a lot, which I think is an important part of writing, you can really make something that's independent and freestanding and kind of heroic and amazing. And I think, you know, all of us have our perfect lengths. I mean, and I think, you know, your listeners all can remember maybe an afternoon when everything went right, where, you know, you had the perfect companion, you had the perfect meal, you had the perfect erotic experience, you had the most beautiful evening. It's very hard to remember the year when everything went right, or even the month when everything went right. But I think as a writer, there are these moments of grace that are visited on us, in which for 20 pages you can do something and incorporate something and enclose something that is bigger than you know, and that can be kind of perfect, like a poem.
Yeah, I want to read your quote about poems. You say, but poem-like, everything in a short story must count, must show. The tale has to ride its own genre. Is that right? While withholding its true method, there can be no dossier background for a character. All must emerge as a central, visible action. Now, there's a lot packed into that, isn't there? Expound on that a little bit.
Well, I mean, the classic mistake, I think, for beginning writers is to do a driver's license description of a character. 5'11 with silver hair and periwinkle blue eyes. D.G. Martin entered the studio forcefully. Whether the eye color and whether the height is pertinent to the action that's being described remains to be seen. I mean, that the information is fed into the mechanism, and it really is a mechanism. It really is a kind of man-made machine, exactly at the moment when we need to know the eye color, when we really need the information.
That can't be irrelevant, because you can't waste a word.
Exactly. And it can't be information for its own sake, or TMI, too much information. It has to appear just when you need to know the eye color or the way a character moves or what a character wants, so that it has a kind of it's a transitive form. It's all action. It's all motion, and it takes a lot of experience and a lot of reading to figure that out. I'm a huge admirer of Anton Chekhov's short stories, and he is a master of telling you only what you need to know about the characters as they exist in real time.
It's a real challenge to tell all you need to know, but only what you need to know.
Exactly.
When I was in the Army, they were teaching us how to spy on people and to tail them. And it said, you know, got to get close, but not too close. You know,
that's right.
You almost couldn't do it.
It's very hard. Yeah, it's a balancing act, and it takes a lot of experience.
Alan Gerganis and I are talking about Southern short fiction. We'll be right back. This is D.G. Martin. I'm talking to Alan Gerganis, and Alan Gerganis, the great writer, is this year a great editor, being in charge of selecting the short stories for new stories from the South, the best of Southern writing or writing about the South in this year. And Alan is talking about the things that he either learned or shared in an essay that he wrote for the Oxford American about this process of selecting the stories for new stories from the South. We're talking about short stories and about Southern writing. I'd like for you to share with us the stories that you told, or some of the things that you described in the essay about how do you say this? Is it just about bad Southern writing? Would you just let me, this is kind of long, but would you let me read the
sure.
story that you constructed? To
oh, great. I'm all for it.
A story that you probably wouldn't select. It's really a composite, I guess, of stories that went directly into the no. That evening the hogs ate Meemaw and Pawpaw, leaving nothing but what we later find stuck way down in their boots. God love them. Was the self-same chilly midnight that Miss Maybelle Pettibone high-dived off the tip of the Holiday Inn's new water feature out on U.S. 70 business the very same night that her worst student ever, Dumbo, DeWitt Dufresne, 38, busted free of the state nut house for criminally insane men in Milledgeville, hitchhiked back our way and a .45 caliber something crammed under his belt and came a-looking Miss Maybelle, the old maid schoolteacher who had taught DeWitt how to French kiss the same night she flunked him in the... And so on. Now,
it actually sounds better than I meant it to.
It sounds pretty good, but they're all the. This is what I had such trouble with because there are these echoes of the hitchhiker, or the Flannery.
The fugitive. That's right.
And there were echoes of great Southern fiction, but it just sounded ridiculous.
Yeah. Well, I think that's the problem. I mean, is that it's all echoes. It's all regurgitated material. It's in danger of being not funny, which is edgy, but cute, which is formerly funny material. And sure, safe bets. Everybody has, all the ladies have three names instead of two. And everybody is an extreme case and a type that we all know. The old maid schoolteacher, the horny convict, the you know, the rotting mansion, the trailer park. It's not to say that these can't be made to yield new material, and they are extraordinarily fertile. But you have to figure out your own way of doing it. And if it's just a question of repackaging and reprocessing material that's been handled better by our betters, then I'm going to put that in the no pile and go on to something else. I'd rather have somebody, as I say in the essay, I'd rather watch somebody try unsuccessfully to jump over a house than to see somebody who can scale a shoebox perfectly. I'm all for taking new chances and attempting new material. It's not to say that the stories in this collection don't include bird dogs and grandpa and grandma and the babies, but I'm looking for something that I haven't heard before. And when you have 800 stories and you can only choose 20 of them, it becomes very readily apparent, like a judge of the pickle-eating contest at the state fair, which is the real bread-and-butter pickle and which, you know.
Well, this comes back in the advice that writing teachers give, I bet you give as well, that seemingly contradictory in some respects. And the first is, to be a good writer, you got to read. You must read a lot. And you say yourself that you read a lot, not just in selecting, not reading 800 stories to select 20, but you always read a lot. You're always.
That's right.
So you advise your students that if you're going to be a good writer, you can't do it in a vacuum. You've got to see what other people are doing. And the other thing that you tell, or that writer teachers tell, is write from your own experience. Write what you really know and honestly know better than other people, not reconstructing the stories that somebody else. But so you got to do these two things. It's kind of like walking a tightrope, isn't it, between knowing what other people have done and then doing your own thing.
It is. It's hard. There seemed to be a disconnect there, but in fact, what you're reading other writers, not to attach their material or steal their subject matter, but to see how they approach their lives and their histories, and how to apply that lesson to your own life, your own little patch of ground. It's all a matter of where the real entrance to the story is. How much background you give, how to begin with a gesture or an action. And the more great writing you read, the more likely your chances are of doing it yourself, because it becomes automatic. I mean, it's an odd thing. You know, occasionally you run into a writing student who really hasn't read anything. And it's sort of like talking to a 350-pound person on a couch eating Lay's potato chips who tells you he intends to become a ballet dancer. And you want to say, when? You know, you have to be doing it all the time, and you have to be inhaling it. It's like you dance. You dance badly, but you dance. You move, and that makes you move better, and you become less and less satisfied with what you did yesterday. I tell my writing students that, you know, reading is inhaling and writing is exhaling, and you can't have one without the other. We're all part of many, many traditions, and it's a huge advantage to know what other people have done.
If your reading is inhaling and your writing is exhaling, where do you find time to have enough living experience and contact with other people and conversations with folks in order to have a bowl full of things to write about?
Well,
unless you're stealing from the people.
No. I think, you know, there are 24 hours a day. It's very hard to read and write all those hours. And that just being alive for a certain number of years means that you're going to lose things, you're going to gain things, you're going to fall in and out of love, you're going to change addresses, you're going to have many hurricanes coming your way. You don't have to climb the Himalayas to have a completely fulfilling and satisfying and dramatic life. You just sit still, as my dear friends in Rocky Mountain in 1999 realized, when, you know, you have a three-story house full of the most beautiful things in the world, and then you go to sleep, and then you wake up, and you're on the roof, and you're swimming to the neighbor's tree to save your life. Stuff happens to you, and it's all more dramatic than we can quite bear. But I think a healthy writer is somebody who spends a certain number of hours a day, you know, reading and writing, and then gets the hell out of the house and goes out to have real conversation and really encounter other people.
Alan Gray Davis, we're going to have to take a short break. We're talking about Southern short fiction, and we'll be right back. Welcome to Who's Talking. We're talking to Alan Gerganus, and our conversation arises because of Alan's work this year as the guest editor of New Stories from the South, a sort of new venture. And so we talked about Southern fiction and talked about short stories and learned a lot, Alan. But, and we've just got a minute or two more. Can we spend this time talking just about what's on your mind and put the literary world aside? What's going on in your life? What are you worried about? What about the future of this region and this country?
Yeah, well, yeah, boy, there's a lot to talk about. I mean, I relate it back to writing. I hope that my writing and my storytelling reflects my political concern and my respect for the everyday citizen who's trying to make sense of his or her life and trying to live decently and take care of their kids and keep the lawn mowed. I'm really worried about this country. I'm really worried about what we've come to represent abroad. I'm worried about the sense of the privileged being the people who are really in control. And I'm worried about the so-called volunteer army, which is really a mercenary army of working class kids, none of whom I know. I don't know one person in the Army or the Navy or the Marines. And I don't expect that anybody who's had, you know, has advanced degrees and is my age would allow their kids to go because they know how hideously dangerous it is and how worthless this Iraqi and Afghani expedition really is. It's as if the U.S. military has become the professional security force for the oil industry. And it's very hard to really respect the mission of our country anymore. I love it. I've spent 3.5 years of my life as in the Vietnam War, and so I speak as a patriot who's really paid his dues, unlike our president, vice president, and secretary of defense. And so I feel very jangled to the point where I don't even subscribe to the New York Times. I go and buy it on the days that I feel strong enough to read it, which is maybe every other day or, you know, sometimes many days in a row, but I'm very, very concerned, and this has an impact on the region because the South provides more military might than any other region. North Carolina is the military. Yeah, that's right. So I'm very, very shaken, and I just saw the Al Gore movie about global warming, and which I found very affecting. And the passages that recount how he lost that election extra-legally, I think, made me and everybody in the theater just cry. I haven't heard people not just sniffling but crying in a theater. I think we've taken a really sad turn.
This is jarring in some respects, but is there an optimistic side to your to the way you are looking at life now?
I guess I would make a distinction. I feel pretty optimistic about my own life. I love my friends. I love the community. I try to be a good citizen. You know, I have a sort of civic imagination, and I try to exercise that. Whether we as a nation can take control of the country again, and I don't think the election is really between Republicans and Democrats anymore. I think there's some sort of moral imperative in the next election. And whether the election machinery is free and clear of bias, I'm not sure anymore. I've watched the last two elections.
You're worried about the counting of ballots.
Yeah, I really am. Yeah, it's so easy to put a fix on these voting machines. I wish I didn't think I sounded paranoid, but I think.
Well, yeah, I think you are paranoid, but it doesn't mean that it's not happening.
More and more, I think the paranoiac is the person with the most information. but I make that split between what's going on the page in my house and what's going on in my neighborhood and what I see as going on internationally.
Is something? Gosh. Well, we'll come back and let's talk about those things. We'll put aside the literary stuff. We'll talk politics, and maybe we'll get some people who disagree with us and have a fight and have some fun.
Oh, good.
In the meantime, though, thanks for sharing with us these things that you shared in your Oxford American essay, and we'll look forward to reading again as a part of New Stories from the South, this year's edition, when it comes out later on this year. Thanks, all y'all, for listening. We'll be back same time tomorrow.